Welcome to Deep Dive Genre. Sarah Kordetsky studied theater, film, and TV studies, Latin American history, and Spanish in Cologne. She's worked for several public TV stations and production companies in Cologne, Berlin, and Potsdam. In 2018, she obtained a doctorate in film studies at the Film University Babelsberg, Konrad Wolf. In her dissertation, she concentrated on the German Heimatfilm, namely the mutual interferences between this genre and the societal development in Germany since the end of World War II, as well as self-reflexive elements and structures in the films of the genre. She's currently working as managing director at the Institute for Artistic Research at the Film University Babelsberg. We talked to her via video call for this interview. Dr. Kordetsky, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
Today, we'll be talking about a genre that is possibly the most specific to Germany of all, Heimatfilm. We will include some recent German films such as Ein ganzes Leben im Weißen Rössel, wie du singst, or maybe even Sissy during our talk. But obviously, we'll be referencing a range of other films as well. A point that came up quite a lot during the conversations I've already had with German creatives about this genre is how conflicted they feel about it, and how it is not something German filmmakers necessarily gravitate towards. So to start, I'd like to ask you a few general genre questions and then get more specific. When did the Heimatfilm genre gain its footing in Germany? Because personally, my first thought would be 1950s, 1960s, but that's not necessarily correct, is it? Because if you go back to the beginning of modern filmmaking, some of the earliest black and white films made in Germany were of the Heimatfilm genre, also during the Wendezeit going up to the end of the millennium. The genre doesn't have the best reputation. Has that maybe even changed? Sorry, those are a lot of questions mixed into one.
I'll just try to answer them all. We'll see. Well, actually, you can say that the Heimatfilm genre has had a presence in popular German cinema basically since the beginning. You already have the Heimat literature tradition, which was really strong in Germany. And of course, when film production started, literary adaptations started as well. And from the beginning, there were literary adaptations from Heimat literature in German cinema. So already during the Weimar Republic and later on, you have these literary adaptation, which is actually a really interesting aspect of the Heimatfilm production, because literary adaptations are present until today. Mm-hmm. So you can see certain topics or even certain novels or dramas that have been adapted on and on and on several times. And to see the changes of how they have been adapted is really, really interesting. Well, you mentioned Im Weißen Rössel. This is one of the examples. Well, this is a special example because it's not literature. It's from theater. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You have the Ganghofer novels, the Anzengruber literature, which has been adapted on and on and on. At the same time, when you talk to people about the Heimatfilm genre, what they first come up with is actually the 1950s and especially West German film production in the 1950s. But then when you talk about history and the development of the Heimatfilm genre, then people often talk about the Bergfilm, which you could say is a genre for itself. Of course, there are personal continuities, there are types of images and plot construction elements that then went into the Heimatfilm production of the 1950s, but actually the Bergfilm is not the only, a lot of other Heimatfilms that have been produced before the 1950s in Weimar Republic and also during the Third Reich.
Yeah.
So then you have the 1950s, and what is special about the 1950s is on the one hand that you have this huge success of popular cinema, that people just went to the cinemas on and on, and it was just so popular in the 1950s. And then you have, of course, a lot more productions than before. When you look at the period from about 1950 to the end of the 1960s, you have almost well, between 350 and 360 productions, movies that have been made that can be seen as Heimat films.
Mm-hmm.
And that basically ended in the 1960s when productions went down. But that's not just the case for the Heimat film genre. Mm-hmm. It was the case for the whole cinema projection because television grew stronger and production structures changed. And so you can't just, well, there are a lot of people that say that in the 1960s, the genre basically died, and this is not true.
Mm-hmm.
It has a great continuity until today, but in the decades after the 1950s, there was just not that much of a production. And then the critical Heimat film came, but that doesn't mean that the popular Heimat film died. It went on too. So you have these kind of two ways of producing Heimat film, a critical way and a popular way.
Yeah.
And that has existed since even before the 1950s, and only that in the 1950s, the popular elements of the genre became much more important. And that's what people associate with the Heimat film.
Yeah.
And then what I found out during my work for my doctoral thesis is that after the millennium, production numbers grew again.
Mm-hmm.
After 2002, you have 10 productions a year and that can be attributed to the Heimat film genre. And after 2008, there were even more than 30 films that were produced each year. So if you look at about the time from 2002 to 2013, which is where I ended my thesis, well, the films, this is what ends in 2013. And so, but basically you have from 2002, the productions rise. And then from 2008 to 2013, you have 30 productions each year, which is basically an amount that is pretty similar to that of the 1950s.
Yeah.
And so what I concentrated on for my doctorate thesis were these two boom phases that you have, these two boom periods after moments in German history where there were ruptures and societal changes that were really, really strong.
Mm-hmm.
So you have 1945 with the end of the Second World War, and then in 1949, the foundation of the two Germanies and huge changes in national territory too. The Heimat films grew very, very, very strong and very, very important. And this is basically what happened after reunification too.
Yeah.
After reunification in 1990, you had some time where things had to just, I don't want to say grow together. So after the reunification of the two German states in 1990, one could say that you have kind of a latency period of a decade. So after the restructuring of German society has gained more footing, Heimat film production rises again, and you have a second boom period. So this is what I found really, really interesting. You have two boom periods. You don't just have a continuous presence of the Heimat film genre just over the whole film history. You don't just have one boom period. You have two. And so what I did in my doctoral thesis was compare these two boom periods and see what you find in the film, which topics and which discourses of contemporary German society you find in the films, and how they are integrated into the plots of the films.
Mm-hmm. Now, we already sort of mentioned that there are main themes and subgenres. Can you give our listeners maybe a few of those that come up again and again, especially in those two periods that you compared?
What the Heimat films always deal with, of course, is the existence of social microcosms.
Mm-hmm.
They normally are staged against a rural backdrop. So you have these rural communities where the communities themselves have to see who belongs and who doesn't belong. Heimat is a lot about belonging. And so a lot of the plots are centered around one figure that returns to Heimat.
Mm-hmm.
So you always have this aspect of people moving away from Heimat, but also coming back. And what happens if somebody who has left the village, who has left the community, comes back? What conflicts can there be? Well, of course, time doesn't stand still, so things have changed. Is it just the person that comes back that has changed, or have things in the community changed? This is one of the basic aspects that has a real importance in a lot of Heimat films.
Mm-hmm.
What you also have is, of course, like a Freudian view on the Heimat films. You have Freud with his concept of heimlich and unheimlich. So the uncanny, like you have the German word Heimat, heimelig, which normally you have as something cozy where you feel warmth and you feel comfortable. But also heimlich is something you do in secret.
Yeah.
So you already in the term Heimat, heimlich, you have this aspect of things that are not talked about, of something that is kept in silence. And then you have the opposite, basically. Well, you would think it is the opposite, the unheimlich, the uncanny, but it is already a part of the heimlich. And this aspect is something also that is just like, you could say it is inherent into the Heimat topic, into the Heimat aspects. It has a strong presence in a lot of the films too. What I already said is that Heimat films gained strong momentum after changes of national territory. So of course, the Heimat films presented images of the new territories, and Heimat is always something that has to do with where do I belong, where do I live, where do I want to live. In films, of course, you have the images that present Heimat. You have some kind of scenery. So the landscapes, the images of Heimat are a really, really important factor of the Heimat films too.
Talking about changes in territory, I also wanted to shine a light on how the genre developed in the GDR as well, because I feel that is something that maybe a lot of listeners don't necessarily know much about. And you've written about DEFA films in your dissertation. What are the similarities? What are the differences in the genre set in these rather different, but also maybe very similar countries?
Yes, what I would say is that the biggest difference between the films, when you talk about the 1950s, of course, is that they were produced in two different states. The politics behind the film productions were different too. And in West Germany and in East Germany, societal structures had to develop, but they developed or were developed in very different ways. Hmm. And so, of course, the films produced were different in certain ways. But what I found really interesting is not to look at the differences, but at the similarities, mm-hmm. because of course, especially in the DDR, they always try to kind of step away from what had happened before. They said, okay, we are creating a new society and we want to see new ways of film production too. They were looking for ways of film production that would reflect this new society that was supposed to be created. But of course, those people working in the film production were those that had worked in film production before too. And they had grown with certain traditions, and the Heimat tradition was one of them. And also the use of certain plot structures, the presence of certain characters in the films. Yeah. And this is something where you find huge similarities, that I would say. The presentation of the landscape, the characters that are presented in the films. At the same time, where you have a huge difference is in the amount of films that were produced. Mm-hmm. So I said in the 1950s into the 1960s in West Germany, you had about 360 films that you could attribute to the Heimat film genre. In DEFA films, I would say there were about 40 films where you could say, okay, they can be associated with the Heimat film genre. And then also you have this public discourse that did not talk about Heimat film at all, because this was a bad genre. Yeah. So the films in the DDR were definitely not labeled as Heimat films.
Mm-hmm. Since we are talking about German films overall, where on the German film scale would you put these DEFA Heimat films? Would you say they are sort of more classical, even though they try to find their own way? Or would you say that they maybe even are a little bit more experimental than the West German ones?
For me, what was most interesting or the most outstanding point is that when you talk about Heimat and Heimat films, generally people say, okay, this is a typically West German thing.
Yeah.
But then when you look at the time after reunification and you have this second boom period, there are a lot of films produced after the millennium that are actually staged in the East German landscapes. Mm-hmm. If Heimat was not present in East Germany, why would there be these films? So this is when I saw the movies produced after 2002. I said, okay, there's a commitment to Heimat. The structures of the Heimat film genre are used especially for film production that is set in the East German landscapes. Mm-hmm. So why is this happening? And what are the traditions that people could relate to? And then you look at East Germany and you see that there were film productions, not just in the 1950s, but this is where they were looking for new ways of film production. And they try to use certain traditions in film production. And you have these structures that are used from Heimat film production. And then in the 1980s, in the DDR, they were trying to make television more popular because, of course, they had this problem that television from West Germany could be seen in East Germany too. And they wanted people to watch their own television programs. And what did they do? They incorporated West German Heimat films into the DDR television program.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Of course, they were not the only movies that was to be seen. But if you look at the archives, you find more West German Heimat films shown on DDR televisions in the 1980s after they have made efforts of restructuring and making the program more popular. So that is what people could relate to after reunification. They had not just seen these movies on West German television, mm-hmm. but even on DDR television.
Hey.
And of course, Heimat, even though for a long time this was not seen, but Heimat had a strong importance in construction of the new GDR state mm-hmm. throughout the whole time of the existence of the GDR. There have been quite some works on it in the past few decades. So this is something people could relate to. And this is what I found most interesting, that on a superficial level, they would say, okay, no, we don't produce Heimat films. We are looking for a new way of creating society. But then, of course, not just in film production, but also in this effort of presenting people something that they could relate to and that they could identify with, Heimat was strongly used, not just in West Germany, but also in East Germany.
Are there any particular films, Heimat films, either from Eastern Germany or former West Germany that you want to highlight from the 1950s and then maybe also from the early 2000s, maybe?
It is so hard.
I know. You know, just tell us your favorites.
I know. It's just to pick something is really difficult because of the what I found so interesting was the great variety. When you hear people talk about the Heimat film genre, they would say, okay, the genre is full of poachers and you always have the landscape. And then you look at the films. And I mean, for my doctoral thesis, I watched over 200 of the 1950s films, then the 40 DIFA films, and then more than 400 of new productions after 2000, just to see if they would be able to be classified as Heimat films or not.
Yeah.
And what I found most impressive was really this huge variety of films and of topics. But yes, I would mention from the 1950s in West Germany, I would like to mention two films. One is Der Meinaltbauer or The Perjurer, where we have one more example of this literary adaptation. Der Meinaltbauer was a drama written by Ludwig Anzengruber. Mm-hmm. And production from 1956, it struck me. It was so impressive because this really is one film from the 1950s, which does not fit into what people associate with the genre at all. It is set in the present, which is actually something that a lot of films do. They're clearly set in the 1950s and not in some pre-modern past.
Yeah.
But it also concentrates on aspects and includes contemporary discourses in the plot structure mm-hmm. in a way that is really impressive. They have ex-police there. They have this conflict around a guild that is not openly talked about. You have this bad past that nobody wants to openly discuss, but which has consequences in the present.
Mm-hmm.
And what I find most interesting about it is that it is really possible that Edgar G. Ulmer was the person who had the most influence on this use of the different topics. And because he spent in the 1950s, he spent some time in Europe trying to gain footing there again and do film productions there. And he is named as the producer of this film. Mm-hmm. It seems from looking at letters in the archive, it seems that he was actually playing with directing the film too. And then he had a heart stroke and he wasn't able to fulfill the contract. But basically the whole preparation and everything had been done by him, and his wife and his daughter were present at the site where the film was.
Yeah, at the shooting.
And so there you have this Europe-based director that went to the United States in the 1930s and then came back in the 1950s who wants to direct this Heimat film. Mm-hmm. And you ask yourself, why did he want to direct a Heimat film? But when you look at the plot and you look at that movie, you know why. But you also know why it wasn't popular. I mean, also, it had a rating that people had to be 16 years old or older to see it. And Heimat films were basically seen as family movies. And mm-hmm. so the normal audience of the movies could not see this movie in the way they would
usually have. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But actually, today, this film is shown a lot on television. So if you talk about what do people see as a typical Heimat film, then I'm actually asking myself if maybe today this has changed, because people can see this movie a lot on German television. Mm-hmm. Another movie that I would like to highlight, or even if you could say there are two movies, are those produced on the history of the Von Trapp family. Mm-hmm. Because it is so interesting, if you look at film production and on an international scale, you have these two film productions. Of course, they were Austrian productions, but then Austrian productions were mainly for the German market in the 1950s.
Yeah.
That tells this story of the Von Trapp who migrated from Austria to the United States because of the Nazis. So there you have this past that supposedly nobody wanted to talk about, but in these films it has a strong presence.
Yeah.
And what I would like to highlight is then you have The Sound of Music.
Yes.
Which is one of the most popular films in the US. I mean, if you come to the USA as a German, I don't know how many people have asked me if I have seen The Sound of Music. And of course I had to see it, and then I saw it and I was like, okay, this is the Trapp family movie from the 1950s produced again in just a different national context. So these are two of the productions from the 1950s that I found really interesting to watch and to see how they were integrated, the discourses of the plots were integrated in the certain national discourse of the time.
Yeah.
And then, well, you already said that we are going to talk about Im Weißen Rössel, wie du singst. And I mean, you have to mention this movie. And it was produced in 2013, which was the last year of my corpus. And I saw this movie. And I mean, if I hadn't decided beforehand that this was going to be the final year of my corpus, this movie would have forced me to finish my corpus in that year, because it's just... Well, everything I wanted to say is included in this movie. The self-reflexivity, we haven't talked about this aspect of Heimat.
Yeah.
When I tell people I was investigating self-reflexive moments in Heimat films, they would be like, okay, what are you doing? And then you watch Im Weißen Rössel, and it's so interesting how they do a really good music film in Germany relating to the Heimat film tradition and the tradition of adaptations of this, how do you say this, operetta. They include everything. I mean, then you have the cuckoo clocks at the wall in the Salzkammergut. Of course, they don't belong there at all, but they belong to the images of the genre, and you have to include them in this film. And I think that they did a really great job in reworking the songs that have been so popular and still very well known. I mean, so many people know the adaptations of Im Weißen Rössel. And they didn't just use the songs in the way people know them, but they reworked them. And I think they did a great job.
Mm-hmm. What I particularly also liked was that that's one of the, dare I say, few instances in German filmmaking where filmmakers take a well-known genre and reshape it, take a new look at it, and modernize it without losing the heart of the original. And I think Germany could use a lot more of that. I mean, if you look at the international productions. I mean, usually it's not musicals. It's more like Shakespeare plays and Jane Austen variations and Bronte variations that are sort of reworked and rejigged for new generations. And I thought this was such a great instance where that happened in Germany, and such a fun production as well.
And with a great sense of humor.
Yeah.
This is something film production sometimes likes too. I don't know if you know Can't Hardly Wait.
Yes.
This is a film hardly anybody in Germany knows, but in English-speaking countries, especially in the US, of course, I think it was really popular, and I loved it when I saw it. And I think that Im Weißen Rössel can be compared to Can't Hardly Wait in the way of how it works certain images or certain well-known moments of other films into the new film.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Because of this, it has a self-reflexive moment. Well, the film is self-reflexive in its way of being produced.
And talking about music, because I found that even though, there's a wide range of films like comedy, drama, musicals, in the Heimatfilm genre, the music and the score plays a very vital part in all of them. Do you have any theory as to why that is? I mean, obviously for musical, sure. But I mean, for the other, subgenres as well, there's always sometimes a big heavy score, or like one popular song or piece of music, or is that just my imagination?
Actually, I would like to differentiate a little, because this is certainly true for the 1950s. And mm-hmm. I mean, there you have a lot of times you have this main song that is played over and over in the film, which gives the film a title. Well, just to say one example, Die Lindenwirtin vom Donaustrand. And I mean, the song you hear over and over in this film is Die Lindenwirtin vom Donaustrand. Da, da, da. So this is really, really typical for the West German Heimat films of the 1950s. Yeah. But then when you look at later productions, music loses this importance in the films. And that's something I find really, really interesting, mm-hmm. especially in relation to German society. Germans and their relation to music, to popular music and to traditional music.
Yeah.
In the 1950s, this was still really strong. The people would sing traditional songs, and they were incorporated into the Heimat films. But I think this is part of German history that then in the 1960s, where a new generation grew up and said, okay, we want to have a break with this history. We don't want this continuities. We want to look at what happened in the past. We want to talk about the crimes that were committed, the genocide that was committed, the war that happens, and everything around this that they said had not been talked about at all before. The songs that were part of the German tradition gained a kind of bad reputation too.
Yeah,
people were reluctant to sing these songs. And until today, I think Germans have problematic relation to their tradition because of this problematic past we have and of the use Nazis made of certain traditions that were already present in Germany beforehand.
Yeah.
And so there's another movie I want to highlight, but it's a documentary, which is called Sound of Heimat, Deutschland singt, or Germany sings. Mm-hmm. The protagonist of the film was an Australian. Certainly he was from an English-speaking country. Yeah. He was not German, and he traveled around Germany looking for people who are singing and looking at what they are singing and in which context they are singing.
Yeah.
And also looking at why a lot of people are not singing.
Mm-hmm.
And you have this documentary in 2012, and then you have Im Weißen Rössel in 2013, which is already also called Wehe, du singst, so don't sing. And deals with this problematic incorporation of music into films.
Yeah.
And this is something that really most of the new productions lack, the use of music in the movies.
Talking about this, the connotations, do you feel that this sort of historicalness, let's call it that, which the Heimat film is associated and burdened with, does it give it a different, let's say, maybe emotional impact, positive or negative for people? Do you think that's why it's such a not well-received genre sometimes, contrary to what it actually shows? Sorry, that was a big roundabout.
I'm trying to think of how to formulate this in a way, because what I experienced when I started to, well, after having taken the decision to write my doctoral thesis on the Heimat film, was especially this, that people would say, okay, why are you doing this? Why are you watching these films? What would you say would be interesting about the films? And I mean, I wanted to state that point that you can have a fresh look at old films, so to say. But it was really hard to make this, to state this point.
Yeah.
Because when you say Heimat film, people are like, okay, this is tradition, this is reactionary. I mean, tradition in Germany has been associated mostly with reactionary, and this is bad because it is associated with the Nazis.
Yeah.
And that is one of the aspects that had mostly influenced the perspective people take on the Heimat film genre.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I think starting from what you said at the beginning, this is why filmmakers are really, really careful to be related with this genre, even though they make films that can be clearly associated with Heimat film, they don't want to be associated with this genre in public discourse.
Yeah. I mean, what's interesting, I talked to a couple of people about newer Heimat films, and some mentioned Goodbye Lenin, and I know someone in particular who doesn't like Goodbye Lenin at all. Not just as a Heimat film, but just in general, you know, because she feels like it misrepresents certain things about the GDR. I found that quite interesting, sort of like who has certain connotations in regards to political, historical experiences. And that is something that even like the, not just the 1950s, but the modern Heimat film can experience as well.
Or what a lot of times has astonished me, that I feel that in Germany, a lot of people expect movies to correctly reflect reality.
You mean like people who watch documentaries? Well, not documentaries, but something that says based on and think it's true, all of it.
But I mean, well, people always look at US film production.
Mm-hmm.
And if you would ask them about good movies from the US, I don't think they would choose, they would necessarily pick a movie that reflects reality correctly. So then why do they do this in Germany with German films, that they say, okay, this is not a good movie, let's take Goodbye Lenin, because it doesn't reflect every aspect of GDR life correctly.
Mm.
I would just say, okay, maybe it doesn't, but maybe it's still a good movie.
Yeah.
So is this the only criterion that we have in order to judge films? No, we don't.
Yeah.
And this is what I think a lot of times is intertwined in Germany, where people say, okay, I have this movie, which maybe even is about some historical moment in German history, but then all they look at is this question, is reality presented in a correct way? And correct way does not even mean, is it realistic?
Mm-hmm.
But I remember Der Bader-Meinhof-Komplex, one of the friends I went with, said afterwards, okay, but then if young people see this, they will get a completely wrong impression of this time.
Mm-hmm.
So this was why he said this movie wasn't good.
Okay.
Because people would get a wrong impression. And like, it's always this educational aspect that you say, okay, you can't show this to people because then they will get a wrong impression.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, judging a film and deciding whether it's good or not, I think has to do with a lot more aspects than just this one.
Yeah. I have to say that was actually something that I found quite interesting and astonishing when I, you know, watched films for this podcast season, to step away from the, oh, this is a Heimat film, and just look at the films as a film in itself. And is it a good film, as in like, does the structure work? Does the emotional plot work? Do the characters work? And so many of them are. Doesn't matter if you're a fan of the genre or not, but just under that aspect, so many are just well-made films. What I also liked, I realized about the genre, was that a lot of these films, even though some of them had like a glossy over versions, there is sort of a promise of a future and of reinvention in many of them. Not all of them, but I would say possibly the majority of them. I think we also see this in current filmmaking. What would you say is the genre's place in today's film industry?
Well, if you look at popular films, mm-hmm. and of course, obviously, Heimat film is basically a popular genre. Popular genres mostly tend to present a happy ending. It's just the way the genre yeah. functions. So yeah, I can criticize this, but then I have to just go and watch a different genre. But also this can have a really, really important function because of, yes, Heimat films present conflicts and they present contemporary conflicts in the 1950s, even in the 1930s and 1940s, and in today's production too. But they don't necessarily present a realistic solution.
Mm-hmm.
This is not what they have to do, I would say.
Yeah.
But what they do is try to reconciliate the positions presented. A lot of times you hear that Heimat film is basically black and white. I have to say, no, definitely not. A lot of times what they do is to even present the supposedly bad people, the bad characters, with all the problems they have, with the conflicts they are dealing with, maybe even with their biography. This is something they seldomly have a complete judgment of, this is a bad person, mm-hmm. and period.
Yeah.
And I think this is something that should be emphasized.
Yeah.
Especially in societies that have experienced such radical changes as you had that in the 1950s and then after reunification, what is really, really important is that society kind of grows together.
Mm-hmm.
The guilt of the past after 1945 was also after 1990. Post-dictatorial societies mm-hmm. have to deal with this problem that the perpetrators are part of the society.
Yeah.
So this kind of reconciliative aspect, I would say,
mm-hmm.
has a really important function.
Mm-hmm.
Even though this may not help to make the movie is a good movie from certain aspects
yeah.
When you look at it as a critic, I would say.
Yeah.
But still, people watch this after the movie has finished. They go on with their life and they have some kind of positive way of looking
mm-hmm.
At the future here at Film University, especially in that area where I am working right now in artistic research. You have this aspect of positive world building.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of movies, when they deal with the futures, sci-fi movies
yeah.
especially, they always have these dystopian views mm-hmm. on the world. And then here a lot of scholars are trying, or not just here, but in this area, scholars are trying to find ways of building positive futures because mm-hmm. this is, in times of crisis, this is especially important for people.
Yeah. You mentioned that you're currently working...
I'm working at the Institute for Artistic Research at the Film University. Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that? What would you say are the main aspects of that?
A step away from the Heimat films
yes.
and the popular film production. Well, this has a lot to do with changes in the university system, not just in Germany, but also in Europe, where this year the Film University has its 10th anniversary of being a university.
Okay.
What is done at a university is research.
Mm-hmm.
But what does a film university do? Of course, it does not only do scientific research, but also artistic research. It's not just about producing films. It's about using the artistic methods we have for research, for looking at society
mm-hmm.
or aspects of today's crises and see what kind of knowledge can we gain with our artistic methods that cannot be gained by scientific research.
Okay. We're going to wrap this up because you've given already so much of your time, but I have two more questions. What is your favorite, possibly German Heimat film and why? And which Heimat film that you watched has been the biggest surprise?
I would like to answer the second question first.
Okay.
Because this was actually one of the crucial moments in my interest for German Heimat film when still studying at University of Cologne,
mm-hmm.
I took part in a seminar on the Heimat film.
Yeah.
And we started the first screening and I was so impressed. I mean, I had seen some films, I had seen the Sissi movies, I had seen the Von Trapp movies, we haven't talked about Immenhof. Those were movies I saw when I was a child. But then, apart from that, I didn't know much about the Heimatfilm genre, apart from what people say about this genre, about the stereotypes, that it was completely escapistic, that reality didn't have a part in these films, that would not at all be connected to contemporary society at all. And then I watched Waldwinter, a production from 1956.
Okay.
And I found the actors Gerd Fröbe and Klaus Kinski in the middle of these movies. And this movie started, I think, in 1944, 1945. So they have a mass in this community, and then a soldier who was part, well, who is from this community, comes and tells them that the front is coming and that they have to flee and have to look for a different place. So you see this moment of being removed, the whole community moving to a different locality at the beginning of this Heimatfilm. It's like, okay, what is happening here? You have this expellee topic. You have then later on this soldier who was a prisoner of war in France, and then he comes back to the community. So I found out that actually all these aspects, life in Germany after World War II, were completely present in this movie. That was a revelation, I would say. Throughout my studies, I was interested in the correlations between movies, society, and history. And I saw this film, was like, okay, this is where I can start looking at Heimatfilms without being bored and without just hating what they are doing.
Yeah.
Because if you are interested in not in seeing a necessarily good movie, but a movie that is dealing with contemporary aspects that have some interrelation with society, then this is one of the genres you should look at. Okay, so now your first question, what is my favorite maybe German, maybe Heimatfilm? For my answer, I'm choosing a Heimatfilm from the DDR, which is called Einmal ist keinmal,
and
which is actually the first film produced by Konrad Wolf.
Oh, wow. Okay.
In the DDR. Yeah. In 1955, he shot his first movie. He was asked to direct a comedy. Which would be popular, but which would still meet the expectations that authorities had about film production. And so he chose the story, which is set in Klingenthal, an area in the former DDR where instruments were built. Klingenthal is set in a region which is now not just, part of it is set in East Germany, part in West Germany, and part in the Czech Republic, where production of instruments had a strong tradition, and this is where they shot the movie about a returnee. I don't know if you can really label him as a returnee, but he's from West Germany, and he's going to spend his vacation time in Klingenthal, where his grandfather is living.
Okay.
I don't think the film makes a point about if he grew up there or not, but yes, he's going to a community where his grandfather lives, so you could still classify him as kind of a returnee. And then he has to see how he is integrated into the community of the young people in this special village or a town.
Interesting. Thank you for mentioning that. That was it. Thank you so much for joining us today and for all your input and the background information you gave us on the Heimatfilm.
Well, thank you for this possibility to talk about one of my favorite subjects.
And we hope, obviously, that many, many of our listeners will maybe give it a try and watch a few old and new Heimatfilm.
Well, at least because of the internet, actually, today it is much easier to find Heimatfilms, even if you're not living in Germany. So good luck on your search for good Heimatfilms.
Deep Dive Genre is produced by German Films, the National Information and Advisory Center for the Promotion of German Films Worldwide. To find out more about our guests, check out the links in our show notes. To stay up to date with our episodes, subscribe wherever you find your podcasts.